Chapter 17, Natural Hypnosis, Healing, and the Transference of Physical Symptoms into Other Levels of Activity. That is the heading. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality. Some people who have been ill for years suddenly recover and then throw themselves into some great beneficial social endeavor in which their own problems are lost and a new stability is maintained. Often this represents a symbolic transference of symptoms from the body outward into the social structure. I will end. I simply wanted to give the heading and the direction. Rob, 1157, yes. Seth, I have one small but important personal note for Rupert. Session 661, May 7, 1973. Continuing, Chapter 17. Rob, tomorrow is Jane's birthday. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, dictation. I am not implying that all social workers are driven by personal problems. On the other hand, it is quite true to say that many such questions turn into challenges with a change of mind, and then are used as impetuses to affect social alterations. In such cases, the dilemma is projected outside of the self and seen as an exterior condition which can be manipulated. Indeed, a magical transformation is involved. This is not to be construed, however, as a statement that all creative acts result from individual problems or neuroses. Quite the contrary, in fact. Such problems projected outward can never really be solved as far as the individual is concerned, of course, since their source is not understood. Rob notes, the phone rang, Jane, as Seth gestured toward it. Seth, you may do as you wish. Rob, but there was only one ring. We waited a moment, then resumed the session. Seth, since the source is not understood, no exterior manipulation in the social structure will be effective enough, and the person involved will see the problem personified in every issue. Hence, even improvements in the social framework will be invisible to the individual's perception, not noticed. They will seem so minute in comparison with the problem. The same sort of reaction occurs if you concentrate upon a personal illness and then find any improvements insignificant because of the great focus of your attention upon the negative aspects. A sudden conversation may completely rid an individual of physical symptoms, any kind of conversation. Under that general term, I include a strong emotional arousal and fresh emotional involvement, affiliation, or sense of belonging. This may involve religion, politics, art, or simply falling in love. In all of these areas, the problem, whatever its nature or cause, is in one way or another magically transferred to another facet of activity, projected away from the self. Huge energy blocks are removed. The man who has believed that he was evil may now see the world or persons of another faith or political affiliation as evil instead. He then feels rid of the problem itself, but is quite ready to attack it in others, and with great self-righteousness and justification. I am making a distinction here between such conversion experience and genuine mystic understanding, which may also come in a flash of time. Mystic enlightenment does not see an enemy, however, and there is no need for arrogance, attack, or self-justification. Love, as it is often experienced, allows an individual to take his sense of self-worth from another for a time, and to at least momentarily let the other's beliefs in his goodness supersede his own beliefs in lack of worth. Again, I make a distinction between this and a greater love, in which two individuals, knowing their own worth, are able to give and receive. You may take a break, or get Rupert some beer, while I leave him in trance. It's up to you. Rob, I'll get the beer, I said, since Jane was doing well, and I felt like continuing. As Seth, Jane sat waiting quietly until I came back from the kitchen. Seth, again, you make your own reality. when you view the world, social groups, political groups, your friends, your private experience, these are all attracted into your realm of activity by your beliefs. Natural hypnosis, as explained in the last chapter, leads you to seek out those situations that will confirm your beliefs and to avoid those that threaten them. You will often try to project a problem outward to free yourself. If this is done, the question at issue will seem forever outside of you, beyond solution, and of mass proportion. Let us look into a situation involving a woman I will call Dineen, who telephoned Rupert today from a western state, and see one of the predicaments that can arise. Dineen is a well-educated woman of middle age with several grown children, financially at ease, possessing all the things that money can buy. She called Rupert nearly in a frenzy. Desperate, she said, for help. Since she has written Rupert several times, he is aware of the situation. Dineen was convinced that she was being cursed, hypnotized, and had fallen under the dominion of another. She had been going from psychic to psychic, dabbling in automatic writing, and seeing little of her husband, who was involved in his own business affairs. She had been told by different psychics that she would be a psychic teacher, and various words and techniques had been given her to ward off the evil influence. Rupert correctly perceived the great need for a zest and excitement in this woman's life for initiative. It was apparent that Dineen sat alone all day in her lonely home with nothing to do, that she was making no effort to face her situation truly, but looking to others to do it for her, and therefore reinforcing her sense of powerlessness. She felt she had no power in the moment. This is an abdication of the severest kind, involving both your spirituality and your biological nature. You feel trapped far more than an animal in a dire situation, and you deny yourself the ability to act. The withheld power is itself transferred then. In Dineen's case, it was put into another. If she could not make decisions, this other person could, through long-distance hypnosis, force her to act whether she wanted to or not. Now, the other individual has no power that Dineen does not possess. Dineen heartily believes in good and evil, so being convinced that she was at the mercy of demonical forces, she began to pray. As Rupert pointed out, however, the prayers themselves were merely a weak surrender to the idea that evil is so powerful. They were not based upon any real belief in the power of good, but only upon a superstitious hope that if bad forces exist, good ones must also. Rupert explained, after hearing about the automatic communications, that these were simply repressed elements of the subconscious finding needed outlet. He suggested that Dineen find herself a job, stop seeing mystics, and assert her own individuality and her own responsibility for action. Dineen believed that other people acted oddly toward her because they had all been hypnotized into doing so. If someone frowned at her, this was the result of hypnotic suggestion. All of this may sound exotic to some of you and be only too real to others. But any time that you assign elements of your experience to exterior sources, you are really doing the same thing that Dineen did. She felt that certain rituals of foods warded off this evil hypnotic suggestion. Yet many of you take vitamins, convinced that they will save you from various diseases. Within Dineen's belief system, she was acting quite rationally, and in your belief system, you are doing the same. You are convinced of the reality of illness. It may not be out to get you as viciously as Dineen believes that evil is bent on threatening her, but the issues are the same. If you believe that you come down with a cold every time you are in a draft, you are using natural hypnosis. If you think that you must come and go at everyone else's beck and call, then you are like Dineen, who believes that she must do what this hypnotist tells her to do. In her case, Dineen gave up the responsibility for action and initiative. Yet, because one must act, the reasons were assigned to another. Rupert also pointed this out. Dineen asked for advice from me, and again, Rupert said, quite correctly, you must learn to stop depending upon others, to use your own common sense. You must stop trying to use one symbol against another, and look at your own life and your beliefs. You can project your dilemmas or your abilities outward into other avenues of creativity then. But until you realize that you form your reality and that your power resides in the moment, you will not be able to solve your problems nor utilize your strengths properly. Now, Dineen carefully chose the territory in which these adventures would take place. For some time, with her children grown, she had felt alone, unnecessary, denied the structure of vital action in which she had to care for her family earlier, and so the great energy of her being, before taken up by her children, had no outlet. Now her life, while difficult, has its own excitement. She is a heroine, battling cosmic forces of good and evil, important enough so that another person even wants to control her. Even the animals seek stimuli and feel a zeal for existence. So in this way, Dineen, in a misguided manner, is still giving expression to a definite need of her being. Rupert also suggested a counselor, but until Dineen is ready to exchange the beliefs she has for others that will allow her to fulfill her own abilities, she will still be in difficulty. Dineen is in excellent physical health, however, and is an extremely attractive woman. She did not choose a situation in which either her health or beauty would be imperiled. She also stayed clear of any sexual involvement outside of marriage. She chose the psychic area because she felt it to be out of the ordinary to begin with, and invested with all kinds of mystery. Any difficulties encountered there would automatically have a kind of glamour and distinction. The more she was reassured by others with the same beliefs, the deeper her involvement grew. Rob notes, now notice how Seth begins to develop some of the material that Jane had received in the sleep state after the last session. See her notes there. Seth. Each individual has what I will call a psychic territory of power. This represents an inviolate area in which the person insists upon remaining supreme, aware of his or her uniqueness and abilities. This psychic region will be protected at all costs, and here there is indeed immunity from all disease or lack. Other portions of the psyche may be battlegrounds for problems, but the individual will not really feel threatened in a critical way as long as this primary territory is intact. For all her talk of desperation, then, Dineen has chosen her field of conflict. She will avoid any kind of disfiguration or severe health problem, which to her would be a far greater danger. Because of different personal characteristics, another individual will hold qualities of the mind, say, inviolate, and work out challenges through bodily illness. Another may choose the severest poverty, projecting into that situation his or her own resolved conflicts. Another way chose alcoholism. In these cases, there can be some feeling of panic if an analyst or friend tries to switch the area of conflict. For instance, the alcoholic is well equipped with the battleground he or she has picked. An ill person, suddenly well, has to face dilemmas that were ignored before or personified in disease. Dineen, denied the support of the framework she had chosen, would have to face the question she had projected there. But all of the inner difficulties can be resolved by understanding that you form your own reality, and that your point of power is in the present. The habit of not facing problems, which indeed are challenges, can be addictive. A feeling of powerlessness in one field can be transferred to others. When this happens through natural hypnosis, then even the psychic territory of power can be assailed. Here the individual becomes thoroughly aroused, threatened, and realizes for the first time, perhaps, the nature of belief and his or her predicament. Here you have life and death struggles in creative terms. Some miraculous cures or changeabouts in midlife occur as a result. All of this is intimately connected with your biological structure, which is meant to follow the conscious mind's interpretation of reality. Give us a moment. As I have said before, your thoughts are reality. They directly affect your body. It seems that you are highly civilized people because you put your ill into hospitals where they can be cared for. What you do, of course, is to isolate a group of people who are filled with negative beliefs about illness. The contagion of beliefs spreads. Patients are obviously in hospitals because they are ill. The sick and their doctors both work on that principle. Rob notes, see the 659th session in the last chapter. It contains other references to this kind of material also. Very intently, all through here, Seth. Women delivering children are placed in the same environment. This may seem very humane to you, and yet the entire system is structured so that childbirth does not seem to be the result of health, but of illness. Stimuli pertaining to health is effectively blocked in any such organization. The ill are gathered together and denied all of their normal and natural conditions, including the compensating motivations that alone would sometimes be enough to restore health, if given time. This isolation would be unfortunate enough without the application of drugs meant to help, but often given without understanding. Loved ones are permitted to visit the sick on but certain occasions, so those who wish them well in their strongest terms, those who are closest to them and who love them, are efficiently prevented from exerting any natural constructive behavior. For all practical purposes, the ill are put into prison. They are forced to concentrate upon their condition. All of this applies quite apart from any other dehumanizing effects, such as overcrowded conditions, the denial of human privacy, and often the negation of dignity. The individual is made to feel powerless, at the mercy of doctors or nurses who often do not have the time or energy to be personable, or to explain his or her condition in terms that he can understand. The patient is therefore forced to transfer his own sense of power to others, which further deepens his misery. This in turn reinforces the sense of powerlessness that initiated his condition. Furthermore, the natural elements of sun, air, and earth are refused him. The stability of familiarity is withdrawn. Now, with your set of beliefs, you are indeed more or less obligated to go to hospitals in severe conditions. I am not saying here that many doctors and nurses do not try their best to promote healing, and certainly healings occur. But they do so despite the system and not because of it. In many cases, the belief of a doctor in a person who is ill revives him and rearouses his own belief in himself. The patient's confidence in the doctor will then reinforce the entire medical procedure, and he may then be filled with faith in his recovery. But as there are natural healing processes within animals, so there are in your race. Illnesses usually represent unfaced problems in your terms, and these dilemmas embody challenges meant to lead you to greater achievement and fulfillment. Because body and mind operate so well together, one will attempt to cure the other, and will often succeed if left alone. The organism has its own beliefs in health and are unconscious on your part. You are a part of your environment. You form it. Yet the energy that forms you and the environment springs alive in each of you through your intersection with the physical world. The sun makes you smile. The smiling of itself activates pleasant memories, neurological connections, hormonal workings. It reminds you of your creaturehood. The old witch doctors operated within the surroundings of nature, utilizing its great healing ability, directing its practical and symbolic qualities in a creative fashion. In your hospitals, however, you take your patients out of their natural environment and often deny them the comforts of creaturehood. There is little emotional involvement. The senile, in their efforts to run away from their closeted rooms in sanitariums, often show far greater sanity in their way than the relative or society who imprisoned them. For they intuitively recognize the need to be free, and they sense the lack of mystic communion with the earth that has been denied them. Rob notes, see the 650th session in Chapter 13. Small hospitals on spacious grounds with freedom for all but the bedridden to use their bodies would far surpass what you have. But in your system as it is set up, such an environment is impossible, except for the most wealthy. Do you want a break, Rob? Yes, I guess so. Break came only so that I could rest. Jane had realized during the delivery that Seth was elaborating upon some of her own data, which is described at the end of the last session. This had been one of those times when, in the context of an excellent dissociated state, both her energy and the material had seemed to be inexhaustible. For the most part, her delivery had been faster than usual, very intent and animated. I read some of the information to her. We had many questions, but decided not to interrupt the session's flow. Resume at 11:55. Seth. In many animal groups, the sick animal isolates itself for a period of rest, in which it is also free to seek out those natural conditions most conducive to its health. It travels to find certain herbs, or it lies in the mud or clay by certain rivers. Often it is helped by others of its kind, but it is free. When and if it is killed by its brothers, this is not an act of cruelty, but an innate understanding that the creature can no longer operate physically without agony. A quite natural euthanasia is involved, in which the patient also acquiesces. In your society, such a natural death is most difficult, and because of the power structures, can hardly be promoted. No one who decides upon death is saved from it by the medical profession, however. On deeper levels, the quite normal desire for survival requires that the individual leave his or her body, in your terms, at one time or another. When that period arrives, the person knows it, and the great vitality of the spirit no longer wants to be encased by a suffering physical body. Yet here the medical profession often takes care to see that every technological advance is brought to bear to force the self to remain within its flesh, when naturally soul and flesh would part. There are normal interlocking mechanisms that prepare the self for death, even chemical reactions that make this easier physically. Bursts of acceleration, in your terms, to propel the individual easily out of the body. Drugs can only hamper this. Certain kinds of medications can indeed help, but those given in your hospital simply drug the consciousness out of its own understanding and inhibit the body mechanisms that make for an easy transition. In your prisons, you do the same thing, of course, isolating groups of people with like beliefs, denying them all natural stimuli so that a greater contagion of similar beliefs ensues. You separate such people from the normal contact of their loved ones and all unusual conditions for growth or development. Now that is the end of our session. Tell Rupert to continue working with this book in his class as he has been doing. And my heartiest regard to you both and a fond good evening. Rob, thank you very much, Seth. Good night. 12:07. Session 662, May 9, 1973. Continuing Chapter 16. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, now, dictation. Most criminals in or out of prison share a sense of powerlessness and a feeling of resentment because of it. Therefore, they seek to assure themselves that they are indeed powerful through antisocial acts, even of violence. They desire to be strong, then, while believing in a lack of personal strength. They have been conditioned, and furthermore have conditioned themselves, to believe that they must fight for any benefits. Aggression becomes a method of survival. since they believe so strongly in the power of others and in their own relative powerlessness. They feel forced into aggressive actions, almost as preventative measures against greater violence that will be done against them. They feel isolated and alone, unappreciated, filled with rage which is being constantly expressed. In many cases, though not all, through a steady series of minor social crimes. This applies whether or not major crimes are committed, so the simple expression of aggression without understanding does not help. In the case of criminals and their belief systems, aggression has a positive value. It becomes a condition for survival. Many other characteristics that might mitigate such behavior are minimized and can be seen as dangerous by them. They believe. Rob notes the telephone began to ring. Seth, do as you wish. Rob, I took the call while Jane came out of trance. It was for her from a woman who lives in New York City. Professional matters were also involved, so their conversation lasted until 10:47. We didn't go back to the session. This made it one of the shortest on record, although without checking, I remember an even briefer, spontaneous one on Christmas Day several years ago. This is a good place to describe Jane's latest psychic thing, as she put it, or experience with an altered state of consciousness. Time about 12:30 a.m. Friday. Place outside one of our favorite dancing establishments, a few blocks down Water Street from our apartment house. As soon as we stepped out of the door, Jane began to talk about the supernal beauty of the warm night. We walked toward our car. A gentle rain had recently stopped, and everything looked washed and renewed. So it took me a few minutes to realize that her perceptions did indeed go beyond that fresh appearance. She began to stop at intervals, exclaiming over all of those surroundings that were, of course, very familiar to us. The swooping automobiles, the street lights, the neon signs, the buildings themselves, the Chemung River rolling quietly behind its dike, in back of the emporium we'd just left. I was suddenly caught up by swift joy, Jane wrote the next morning. The night colors damned near transfixed me. They were so brilliant, glowing, and spectacular. This was the first time I had had such an experience outside walking. I found my body moving faster, easier, freer. It was an instant thing. It was so joyful, I couldn't sleep for a while. Later I wished I'd asked Rob to drive around so I could prolong it, but neither of us thought of doing that at the time. For notes on a couple of Jane's other experiences with altered states of consciousness, see the 645th session in Chapter 11 and the 653rd session in Chapter 13. Session 663, May 14, 1973, continuing Chapter 16, The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Seth, now. Dictation. I put back Rupert's curls. Rob notes. As Seth, Jane pushed her hair back over each ear. It had been falling forward each time she lowered her head. Seth. You isolate the criminal element, therefore, in an environment in which any compensations are refused. The entire framework of a prison, with its bars, is a constant reminder to the convict of his situation and reinforces his original difficulty. Any normal home life is denied him, and along with the overall concentration upon the problem at hand, all other stimuli is purposefully held to a minimum. In their ways, the warden and guards subscribe to the same set of beliefs as that held by their prisoners. The idea of force and power is accentuated on both sides, and each believes the other its enemy. The guards are certain that the incarcerated are the dregs of the earth and must be held down at all costs. Both sides accept the concept of human aggression and violence as a method of survival. The prisoner's energies are usually used in boring, innocuous tasks, even though some attempt is made to provide vocational training in many institutions. Both prisoners and officials, however, take it for granted that most of those now behind bars will return time and time again. The confined project their personal problems out upon the society. Society returns the favor. In the same way, individuals often think of certain characteristics as animal or evil and attempt to isolate those portions from other areas of their own activity. Power, or the lack of it, and the attitudes surrounding either mode are often involved. Remember Augustus in the case mentioned earlier in the book. Rob notes, see chapter 6 and the 633rd session in chapter 8. Seth, Augustus felt powerless, considering power in terms of aggression and violence. So he isolated that portion of himself from himself and projected it into a second self. Only when this second self became operative could he display any power. Because his basic concept held aggressiveness and power as one, however, then the strength to act automatically meant the strength to be aggressive. And here aggression was equated with violence. Now in its way, that was a transference of a problem in a unique manner. The need to act and be in control of action is paramount in conscious beings. Augustus, therefore, actually created from himself a position of power from which he could, at least for a while, operate. He had to pretend amnesia so as to hide this mechanism from himself. As long as power is equated with violence, then you will feel it necessary to regulate normal aggression in your behavior. And considering power as violent, you will be afraid to act to some extent. You will then consider goodness and powerlessness to be somewhat synonymous and equate power with evil. Not wanting to face such evil in yourself, you may then direct it outward and transfer it to another area. As a society, you may project it upon the criminal. As a nation, upon a foreign country. As an individual, you may place this power upon an employer, a labor union, or any other segment of society. In whatever area you choose, though, you will feel relatively weak in comparison with the strength that you have projected outward. You meet your own denied power, you see, whenever you find yourself in a situation where you feel weak in comparison to another person or situation that frightens you. Once again, Rob notes, Seth started enlarging upon the material Jane had written during the early morning hours of May 3rd, after receiving it in a sleep state. See her notes at the end of the 660th session in this chapter. Seth, power does not basically impute superiority over. There is the power of love, for example, and the power to love. Both imply great action and vitality, and an aggressive thrust that has nothing to do with violence. Yet many people have physical symptoms or suffer unpleasant situations because they are afraid to utilize their own power of action and equate power with aggression, meaning violence. Rob notes, see 634th session in chapter 8. Seth. Such feelings arouse artificial guilts. The individual who speaks out most loudly for the death penalty feels that he himself should really be condemned to death to pay for the great aggression, the violence within him that he dares not express. The criminal or murderer being executed dies for the evil within each member of his society then, and a magical transference takes place. Love is propelled by all the elements of natural aggression, and it is powerful. Yet because you have made such divisions between good and evil, love appears to be weak and violence strong. This is reflected in many levels of your activities. The devil becomes a powerful evil figure, for example. Hate is seen as far more efficient than love. The male in your society is taught to personify aggressiveness with all those antisocial attitudes that he cannot normally demonstrate. The criminal mind expresses these for him, hence the ambiguous attitudes on the part of society in which renegades are often romanticized. The detective and his criminal wear versions of the same mask. Following such ideas, you end up with suggestions in which the ill, being powerless, are isolated. The criminals are kept together, and the old are held in institutions or in cultural ghettos with their own kind. Transference of personal problems are all involved here, and clusters of beliefs. The criminal elements represent the individual's own feared and unfaced aggressions. These fears are closeted on an individual basis, and those people who express them socially are imprisoned. The enforced incarceration of violent men often leads to a riot, and the private closeting of normal aggression often brings psychological rioting and outbursts of physical symptoms. In all cases, little effort is made to understand the basic problems beneath, and the social segregations merely build up the pressure, so to speak, so that those with like beliefs are kept in situations that only perpetuate the basic causes. Unknowingly, the sick often give up their power to act in a healthy manner to the physicians. The doctors accept this mandate since they share the same framework of belief, so the medical profession obviously needs patients as badly as the ill need the hospitals. Society as you know it, not understanding the nature of normal aggression, considers it violent. The prisons and law enforcement agencies need criminals in the same way that criminals need them, for they operate within the same system of belief. Each accepts violence as a method of behavior and survival. If you do not understand that you create your own reality, then you may assign all good results to a personified God and need the existence of a devil to explain the undesirable reality. So churches, as they now exist in Western society, need a devil as well as a God. Natural aggression is simply the power to act. You may take your break. Your own attitude about these issues will tell you much about yourself and influence your personal reality. If you equate power with youth, then you will isolate the elderly, transferring upon them your own rejected powerlessness, and they will seem to be a threat to your well-being. If you agree that violence is power, then you will punish the criminal with great vindictiveness, for you will see life as a power struggle, and will concentrate upon the acts of violence about which you read. This may bring such aspects into your personal life so that you yourself meet with violence, hence deepening your conviction. If you accept the basic idea that evil is more powerful than good, then your beneficial acts will bear little fruit because of your own framework. You assign such small power of action to them. There are many subsidiary beliefs connected to these convictions. They can all work in such a way that you deny yourself the use of your abilities, and this in turn causes you to project them outward upon others. If you accept the idea that knowledge is bad, for instance, then in line with that belief, all of your efforts to learn will be futile or bring you great discomfort. You will not trust any knowledge that comes easily for you, will feel that you have to pay, do penance for the attainment of any wisdom. Fundamental interpretations of the Bible often lead to such conclusions, so that the pursuit of knowledge itself, which has a built-in biological impetus, becomes a taboo activity. You must then project wisdom onto others and reject it in yourself, or be faced with a dilemma in personal values. Throughout the Dark Ages, monks, priests, and religious organizations have become segregated from the rest of humanity. They have been alternately honored and feared, loved and hated. Their knowledge has been envied and yet held in superstitious awe. The voodoo and the healer, the witch doctor and the priest are all held in honor, yet are also looked upon with a certain terror because of the power and knowledge involved. The man who heals or the man who curses both imply a power of knowledge to many individuals. To those who are caught up with fundamental ideas in pious terms, religious power is a frightening thing. Normal aggression, seen as evil, is therefore segregated within the self and also seen everywhere outside, period. Some individuals will make certain artificial divisions within their own lives, in which it is safe to act in certain areas, not dangerous in others. If you believe that wealth is evil, as an example, you automatically rob yourself of any ability that might bring you riches. Talents that are accepted as good in themselves may be inhibited simply because their fulfillment might lead to success in financial terms. Your beliefs then are highly important in the way in which you handle the power of personal action. The use of your private energy brings you into intimate relationship with your own source of power. Healing involves great natural aggressive thrusts of energy, growth, and the focus of vitality. The more powerless you feel, the less able you are to utilize your own healing abilities. You are then forced to project these outward upon a physician, a healer, or any outside agency. If your own belief in the physician works and you are cured of symptoms, you are physically relieved, and yet your own belief in yourself may be further infringed upon. If you are making no effective efforts to handle your own problems, then the symptoms will simply reappear in a new fashion, and the same process will be reinitiated. You may lose faith in your doctor while still retaining confidence in doctors as a whole and run from one to another. But the body has its own integrity, and illness is often simply a natural sign of imbalance, a physical message to which you are to listen and make inner adjustments accordingly. When these realignments are always made from the outside, the body's innate coherence becomes jeopardized, and its intimate relationship with mind confused. More, its natural healing powers are dulled. The built-in initiating triggers of reactions that are meant to follow inner stimuli are activated instead of exterior means. The individual's faith is transferred more and more to an outside agency. This usually means that no time is allowed for necessary inner dialogues of self-questioning and the self-healing that might otherwise occur if brought about through belief in another. This can only go on for so long, however. I am dealing here mainly with Western culture. In some other civilizations, and particularly in the past as you think of it, witch doctors operated within a context of nature accepted by all. The witch doctor, while initiating natural forces on behalf of his patient, who seemed momentarily unable to do so, was then returning the patient to the source of himself and reviving his own buried sense of power. That is the source of physical life and the sense of power in action. When a man or a woman feels powerless, as you think of it, he or she will die. The point of power, again, is in the present, when your non-physical self merges with corporal reality. The recognition of that fact alone can revitalize your life. You can take your break, or end the session as you prefer. Rob, we'll take the break then. Now, Seth. In your terms, you are in a state of evolution as a species. Part of this experience includes a natural fascination with exterior events. You are developing properties of consciousness that are, in their own way, uniquely your own, as your environment is. A strong focus is a necessary counterpart, since you are involved in a learning process in which all elements inherent in the situation will be explored. Throughout this venture, however, you are, in the dream state, always kept in touch with the realities from which your physical experience springs. As you understand time, you will eventually be able to merge your inner comprehension with your physical self and form your world on a conscious basis. Such manuscripts as mine are meant to help you do precisely that. The more involved you become with complicated physical organisms, the more energy you project outward, and the more entranced you become with exterior manifestations. In itself, this was, and is, a natural learning method. Your inner life is being translated into corporeal reality. As you perceive it and relate to it, you begin to question first its origin and then its meaning. This leads you back into yourself, and to a recognition of your own abilities. What you now create unconsciously, your species will create consciously. The finite abilities of consciousness become individualized, focused into a particular reality, which then becomes expanded. Your own corporal creations add to the abilities with which you made them. You learn through your creations. Mind, as physically directed, utilizes the greatest source of energy and power, along with unlimited aspects of creativity, so that each physical day is indeed absolutely unique. You cannot expect any portion of your environment to remain static, therefore, and the condition of your body is constantly in a state of flux and change. Your social structure, from the largest metropolis to the smallest farm, from the wealthiest areas to the poorest ghettos, from the monasteries to the prisons, reflect the inner situation of the individual self and the personal beliefs that each of you hold. If you utilize the point of power properly, Rob notes as described in 657th session, chapter 15, you will fill the non-physical energy translated into effective personal power through your intersection with flesh. You will be able to use that power consciously, with purpose, to change your personal experience, and so to change the social framework at least partially. Such experiences aid in the evolution of your consciousness, and will also serve you in fashions you may not suspect. The acquiescence to your own power will automatically flow through your experience, activating your dream life as well, and providing additional helpful impetus to your waking reality. You will no longer need to transfer your sense of power to others. All of the exercises given earlier in this book are prerequisites, however. They are necessary so that you understand how the point of power is to be used. The recognition of personal feelings and the working through of beliefs, all of this will expand your understanding of yourself. If you hate a parent, for example, you cannot use the point of power to tell yourself that you love the parent instead. The earlier exercises will have helped you understand the reasons for the hate. You cannot use the point of power to gain control over another, for your own beliefs will automatically trap you. In any case, you must be aware of your own power and belief, that you are worthy of it. Many of the previous chapters in this book have been written precisely to convince you of your own worth. You have been told to experience your feelings and not to deny them, so you are not to use the point of power as an attempt to refute the reality of your emotions at any given time. As you understand the nature of natural hypnosis, you will no longer feel the need to generate new negative feelings. Your load of inhibitions will recede. As you trust yourself more, you will naturally express your feelings, and their suppression will not bring about explosive reactions anymore. They will come and go. The channel to power will be opened more clearly. Attention to your own stream of consciousness is highly important. This alone will help you see in what areas you are denying impulses or giving yourself directions that lead to powerlessness. The point of power exercise is meant to familiarize you with your own energy and your ability to direct it. The natural hypnosis exercises, given in the last chapter, allow you greater effectiveness in directing and focusing that power. Each of you must work from the point of your own reality. There is no other way, period. If you feel filled with rage, then do not say, "I am filled with peace," and expect results. You will only be blanketing your feelings and inhibiting your power and energy. If you are furious, then beat a pillow and experience the rage, but without violence to another. Work it through until you are physically exhausted. If you do this honestly, the reasons for the fury will come to you, and they will often be quite obvious. You simply did not want to face them. In almost all cases of this kind, your feelings will represent a sense of powerlessness on your part. where you delegated strength to a situation or to an individual and felt your effort futile in contrast. Then use the point of power and feel the energy of your own being surge through your experience. The knowledge of your own power releases you from all fears and hence of all rage. End of session. Rob, all right. Seth, a fond good evening to you both then, in your point of power and ours. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night. Jane's trances had been uniformly deep throughout the session, her deliveries strong, steady, and businesslike. She told me that Seth would soon be going into the effects of our beliefs upon our environment, explaining how our racial mental climate is responsible for our exteriorized weather. He plans to use local aspects of the Great Flood of June 1972 as the focal point for his material because we'd had personal experience with the disaster here in Elmira. Rob notes, see the notes for the 613th session in Chapter 1. Seth, Jane added, would say that as a species, we've grown used to thinking of ourselves as being outside of nature, so much so that we've forgotten we're really part of it. Section 664, May 21, 1973. Rob notes, no session was held last Wednesday so that Jane could rest. Seth devoted the first delivery this evening to material for her, then began working on his book when break ended at 10:07. Seth, now dictation. There is a constant give and take between each individual and his or her society. The divisions and characteristics of any particular civilization will be a perfect exterior representation of the overall attributes of the people within it, as they relate to one another and as they see themselves. The exterior dimensions are replicas of interior personal ones. The accomplishments, wars, difficulties, and institutions are all after the event. That is, they are outward actions of an inward existence. Under certain conditions, water turns into ice. In the same way, interior events can appear in physical reality in a quite different form than the original. As creatures, you are a part of nature. The change of thoughts, feelings, and beliefs into physical, objectively perceived phenomenon is as natural as water changing into ice, for example, or as a caterpillar turning into a butterfly. You not only form the structure of your civilizations and social institutions through the transference of beings, thoughts, and feelings, but in this natural exchange you also help on quite intimate levels in the psychic manufacture of the physical environment itself, with all of its great sweeping variety and yet seasonal stability. Medicine men may do a rain dance. They understand the innate relationship that exists within all portions of nature. You are taught to believe that faith can move mountains, yet many of you will find it extremely difficult to accept your own relationship with the environment. Your beliefs, often as opposed to your desires, cause wars. Your feelings represent the inner reality behind what you think of as purely natural phenomenon, such as weather. Rob notes, Jane had touched upon this material in her notes of May 3rd, which are attached to the 660th session and again after the last session. Seth, catastrophes, such as earthquakes or floods, are not perpetuated by certain elements of nature against other portions of itself. Your feelings have as much natural validity as the tides, and they have their own kind of attraction. Mind does move matter. A ring manipulated at a seance under controlled conditions is but the most simple kind of demonstration of the great ability of mind to interact with matter. You each participate in the creation of each thunderstorm, each a new spring, each flood, earthquake, and summer rain. A war is one kind of natural event brought about as feelings and beliefs interact on one level. A natural catastrophe represents the same kind of phenomenon at a different level. Your part in these feelings and beliefs will place you in your own natural position, within such events. End of chapter.